He was the voice of the...
I want to switch gears this evening to a totally different kind of discussion in terms of poetics of preaching. This doesn't come naturally to me. I told you that I was a chemist. Didn't tell you I was a mathematician. Languages don't come easily, although those dead ones I seem to absorb better than living languages. I avoided, even though I studied University of Chicago, which is a classical liberal arts college, and was forced to take Common Core courses in humanity and philosophy and all that stuff. I kind of rigorously avoided things that was language oriented, because I was a science and math geek. And then I discovered years later that what I wanted to do was work in a vocation that was all language, so that that teaches you something, I suppose. Thank God for the liberal arts education, though. I have since two things that I learned to love when I studied theology. I learned a love for history that I never had when I was in college. I really didn't like history. It was in seminary that I really developed a deep love and appreciation for history, because it really is the record of the gospel is historical. And history is so important to the Christian faith. It's a historic faith, Da Vinci Code notwithstanding, I suppose. The other thing I learned is a love for language. And probably for the first time in my life, I started reading poetry and paying attention to literature and having to learn how to write in other than technical. There's a technical style that you learn when you're writing papers for chemical journals, but that doesn't really go well for writing for seminary term papers, and that doesn't go well for writing sermons. And so, and over the years, I've paid more and more attention. Writing is a painful process for me, but I do like it. It's the counterbalance to building. But I can't do both. I read somewhere, I think it's in the book of Baruch, in the Apocrypha, that it says that the hands of the scribe must remain idle. So, and I find that when I'm in the midst of a home improvement project, my writing output goes to zero. I've been rebuilding and doing trim carpentry, and I still don't write. I think part of it's just the way the brain is. We're wired to focus on certain tasks. But I like the balance. But words don't come all that naturally to me. That's an acquired thing. But it's caused me to pay some attention to the poetics of preaching, and this is weird, because this is not really the what, it's the how. And I think we're sometimes a little bit reticent to talk about the how, because we really believe firmly if we get the what straight, it'll all work, kind of ex opera operato. It'll just work because we said it right. And that there's a lot of truth to that. It's not our word, it's God's word. And yet there's a marvelous thing about the scriptures, is that if all God wanted to do was give us some propositional truths about salvation, he could have accomplished this in about 10 short sentences. We don't need 66 books of, you don't need the book of Ecclesiastes to get the article of justification and all of its ramifications. But God instead, he sent a poet. He did not send, a set of propositions. Remember that? Anybody see that stupid movie Contact, that Jodie Foster movie with Carl Sagan?
Oh, that was brilliant.
I love that movie. I do. I like it for two reasons. It's a great sort of example of intelligent design, because how do you tell the difference between random noise and a signal, and it's that string of prime numbers that just really appeals to me. I just love that. But I like the line from Jodie Foster when she goes into this alternate universe, guided by this alien intelligence, and she goes into this alternate universe, and she says, she's this hardened scientist who has no emotions, not a poetic bone in her body, and she says, it's so beautiful they should have sent a poet. And I thought about that. I said, God did. The first chapter of the Bible is poetic. Now, of course, we try to make a scientific text, and that's really unfortunate. But it's a marvelous piece of poetic. It's true. Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong in that machine over there. But it, you can say so much more poetically than you can say in just by stating facts. That's why the Psalms had to be in Hebrew. That's why the prophets have to be in Hebrew. Multiple meanings, double entendre, layers of meaning. Hebrew just revels in that. And so in our preaching, too, I think paying attention to the poetics of preaching is paying attention to the poetics of the scriptures. Scriptures are very poetic. 66 books of rhetoric, persuasive speech of all sorts, polemics, poetry, apocalyptic. That's cartoons. Revelation. You know? That's in primary colors. That's cartoons. Don't try to dissect that. Just take a bath in the images. That's a slideshow. And then I saw. You know, the guy doesn't make any sense, you know, but it doesn't have to make it beautifully. Just look at the pictures. I love that stuff. But that means we're tuned into the nuances of the literature. We did a little bit of that in that discussion that we had afterward. You know, people looking at why all of a sudden do we quote Jesus in Aramaic Ephatha? Yeah, that's a literary device. Or all the ands. You know, look at how Mark uses ands. They break every once in a while. You know, and he said, I'm done with that thought, new thought. But with Mark, you can't just stop with this pericope. Mark would hate the pericope system. He says, you don't have enough chi's in there yet. You need more ands. Because there's a flow and you can't stop it. This is all poetics. To pay attention to poetics is to pay attention to our hearers. That's the care and concern that we have for the people that we're preaching to. That's being tuned into their ears, and their ears are weird these days. I don't know about how. I'm assuming we have a lot of commonality because, you know, TV is pretty much the same, the internet's the same, so it's all pretty global. And that's one of the things. This is a global kind of culture now. Where people are able to sample things from all over the world right out of the comforts of their own home, and they're far less isolated than they've ever been. Some characterizations of what I perceive as our hearers, they are postmodernists, whether they want to admit it or not. We are all too. It's not all bad. Modernism is a bad idea. So postmodernism isn't necessarily all bad. I like some of the stuff of postmodernism. But the bad stuff comes with things like language deconstruction. Words don't mean what words mean. Now we just politically define a word however we need to use it. So now, you know, we're saying, well, what does marriage mean? You know, we need to define it. We need to redefine it. We do this with everything. And then when you want to gain a hold of a word, you evacuate its meaning and you put new meaning into it, and then dare people that that's not what the word means. That's those word games. Historic revision, that's the other bad thing. That history is no longer something that deals in objective facts, but now it's matters of opinion. And gee, we can't really know about anything. Did Jesus have kids? Well, he could have. I don't know. It seems reasonable to me. And, you know, so you have this whole thing where you can rewrite history without a shred of evidence because, well, you know, the winners wrote the history, and we have to look, you know, we have to look deeper. We have to look at the minority opinion and stuff. And those two are devastating to the gospel. Language deconstruction, historic revision, that undermines the Christian faith. That's a 1-2 punch. Because the word and the historicity of that word, this is just killer. Related to that is relativism. Everything is relative, you know, and everything is individually referenced and defined. That wedding that I went to that I lamented a bit and learned that joke about Emerson, you know, when they're giving the toasts, the groom stands up and says, what a great thing it was that we decided to live together a year ago, and we kind of, you know, we got into this household thing, and now we got married. And then the best man stands up and says, you know, my current wife and I, we got a lot of courage to move in together by seeing these two, and what a great example they were. And I lean over to the person next to me, and I say, I'm going to try that with my Toyota dealer next time I want to buy a car. Can I take this for a spin for 6 months before I commit to buy it? But for them, they define this as a moral and ethical decision on their part, because they didn't want to enter into marriage lightly. They took marriage really seriously, so they wanted to practice for a year to see if they're really going to make a go at it. And for them, that was an ethical and a moral decision. And likewise with the friend, everybody's just kind of nodding their heads, like, you know, there are a bunch of bobbleheads there, and I'm saying, you know, what universe did I just get transported into? Another characteristic is that the culture to me appears very anti-institutional. That's a postmodern tendency. Institutions are not to be trusted. That means church too, in all forms. So everything's up for grabs. Everything is questioned. And it is wearying. You have to defend every statement has to be defended. And I think the work's harder today than it's ever been before, because nothing is non-negotiable. You know, even amongst the diehards, nothing is non-negotiable. I gathered some characteristics of culture that arise out of that I think are helpful to think about in our hearers. One is at least I perceive, a tribalism, increasing tribalism. Let me tell you what that means. Apple versus PC. You know, in my country, Sprint versus Horizon. I just got a cell phone last week. First cell phone I ever owned. I get it now, by the way. You know, I drive horribly now. You know, when I get bored with my wife, talking to my wife over the table, I just get on the cell phone, talk to somebody else. It's beautiful. I love this. I get cell phone culture. You know?
Are you retracting that thing you wrote on your blog?
No, I have to write a new one now. It's the I get it. I was wrong. I get it. I used to be a defensive driver. Then I got a cell phone. Now I drive all over the place. Let everybody else worry about me. You know. But I get the cell phone. They said, what plan did you get? Because, you know, in network, it's free. I said Verizon, and so my higher things crony said, all the cool people get Sprint. And I said, well, I'm glad to know that the cool people are going to have to pay to talk to me. I have to pay to talk to them, too. That's why I learned that ignore button right away. Oh, ignore. Yeah, that's going to cost me. Hip-hop, classical, music is like that. The kids are tribal. I mean, the high school, hang out with high school kids, they're tribal. There's tribes, and they're at war. They'll kill each other over things. At least in L.A. they will. They literally will kill each other. And it's not always race and ethnicity either. There's all kinds of ways. If you're all the same race, then you got to figure out some other tribe to do. You know. The other thing is communication. Lots of communication or a communication culture with no communion or community. Communion and community are the big words. Those are the ones that are. That's where there's commitment, relationship. This is just chatter, you know. This is the cell phone and email and MySpace, but it's not the family, the congregation, my brothers and sisters, my neighbors. You know, somebody told me that the paradigm of Southern California life is the garage door opener. Is you can drive up, you're in your own car, in your own world, and of course we never have two people in a car. We define a carpool, by the way, as two people. You know, which is kind of amazing. Even the carpool lane, they just ignore that. But you know, we're all driving around in our car, spend at least 2 hours a day going each way in our cars. Get home, open the door automatically. Not my garage, but you know, some people's garage. Open the door, drive in, go into the house. You never see your neighbors. You never talk to your neighbors. Just insulated. We have walls between our and you need them too. Walls do make for good neighbors. We have 6 foot high concrete walls to keep neighbors out of sight, out of mind, and stuff. And you really have to work hard to get to know your neighbors. No communion, no community. Even my congregation is a commuter congregation. They come from all over. They're the refugees from the church growth congregations or the praise people. And so, you know, they want liturgy, and so they come. But we don't have that cohesive community because they don't see each other at the store. They're not accountable to each other during the week, and we suffer as a result of that. Individualistic, my symbol for that is the iPod. I got one of those too. Somebody gave me one of those. Now I have permanent tinnitus in my right ear as a result of those. But that was Neil Young, Greek Theater, 1982. What a great concert that was. I'll never forget it. But, you know, everybody can tune into their own tribal music. They got background music for their own life. They're kind of just going along. I'm waiting for the day when the hymn of the day is you just kind of dial in your own favorite hymn and listen to it, you know, so that we can all be together.
That's a great idea.
I'm sorry I said it. I always know somebody's going to use this. The screen, the ubiquitous screen, everything. It's like George Orwell now. Everything, we go to a conference and we don't look at the speaker anymore. We look at his image on a screen. Even when we're sitting in the front row and we could see him, we look at the screen. We're naturally tuned in. because our generation, you know, that's what raised us, was the screen. I know the theme songs for all, like, the old TV shows, you know, Gilligan's Island. I can entertain for hours on end, Mr. Ed. I can sing all the theme songs.
It's kind of like Fahrenheit 451 as well, where all the books are outlawed, and so everybody just watches everything on these massive wall-sized TV screens.
The screen. We're a visual audio culture. We used to be audio-visual, now we're visual audio. And the audio is really kind of irrelevant. It's visual.
We were eating pizza the other night, and there's who knows what it was on, but it had the subtitles on. And it was all the four of us could do to not sit there and read the TV.
Yeah.
Even though we didn't even want to care, we're just like...
Yeah.
Watch the hypnotic power of the screen. You get a bunch of people, college educated, post-college grad, you know, educated, sitting in a room drinking wine, having a good time. Somebody clicked the TV on. Instant silence, everybody staring at the thing. And it's not hockey night either. Now, I'm not talking about that. That's a great exception to the rule. But
your audience.
That's right. Historic ignorance. It goes with historic. You can get away with historic revision if people are historically ignorant. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people who say, well, it could be true, you know, the Da Vinci Code, it could be true. Mm-hmm. The Gospel of Judas, well, that's a possibility, you know.
5% of the French, 12% Americans, 17% Canadians, according to something I just read.
Oh, yeah? That's kind of scary. I mean, that's a big chunk of people.
But certainly not St. Matthew. Certainly not St. Matthew's
no.
Gospel. It couldn't possibly.
That couldn't possibly. Yeah, that's right.
0%.
That's right. Leonard Sweet, whom I appreciate. Leonard Sweet's a kick. If you ever want to read kind of fun things on a website about just things, you know, he's kind of a cross between George Carlin and, I don't know who, I'm trying to figure out who, but he's a very George Carlin-esque kind of guy, but he's kind of a church futurist, and he's at Duke University, studies the emergent church movement, but he talks about our brains are being rewired. And that's probably true, because we have locations in our brains for visual, for audio, for language, and how much you use them kind of determines how active they are. And our brains, whether we know it or not, are rewired. We write differently, because we write at keyboards. Previous generation wrote by hand. Do we write better or worse than they? I don't know. Dr. Nagel says the theses are poor quality today in terms of content. They look nice, great graphics. You know, all kinds of fonts. Couldn't do that with the types of the Emanuel Smith Corona. You couldn't do that. But he says content, there's something wrong. The thoughts are not flowing logically. Because I think because there's pain in writing it out, and there's pain in rough drafts, you have to be committed to those words. I have no commitment to the words I write. I throw them up there to see how they look. It's Jackson Pollock kind of painting. Let's just take a bunch of you know, that looks nice. All right, that's good. I find, especially amongst my younger members, that we have critics of the word, not hearers. They will be critical of every. It's tough because they're critical. They know doctrine, and they're critical of doctrine. They're critical of exegesis. They will argue with you over, you know, points of scripture, which is good. I think it makes for a lively conversation. But we have to be prepared to meet that because people are critical and they don't trust the church and they don't trust representatives of the church. And everybody is an expert. One of the beautiful things, not everybody is willing to go into brain surgery. Or my wife had lower lumbar surgery, a microdiscectomy. I don't think many people would say, I could do that. That's, you know, it's kind of, it's bloody, it's gory, it's risky, could paralyze somebody. So we're not, but theologians, gosh, everybody can do that. You know, that's what I love about our profession. Anybody can do it. You know, you got a Bible. Yeah, I can do that. I'm kidding. But, it, you know, it's true. People do think that.
Oprah's great.
Huh?
Oprah's great.
Oprah. That's right. The high priestess of American civil religion.
Very much so.
Just one question.
You know, and she has a very big pulpit.
Yeah, Joel Osteen's got nothing on here.
That's
Joel.
Yeah,
he should get away hard.
That's right. Yeah. And he's got enough of his own. He probably could. Now the challenge is how do you preach? You know, it's an oral word, and how do you preach to a culture that's thinking like this? I'm not ready to abandon the oral word yet.
Don't move on. I want to hear the good parts about postmodernism.
The good parts? Oh, you want to, okay.
You said there were good parts.
There are good parts.
But I haven't heard that yet.
Okay. Well, I was just moving on. I was just saying the very, okay, you want to know the good parts. Modernism was very optimistic about especially scientific and technological man, that somehow we could fix everything. And postmodernism does not share that view. Postmodernism in many ways is very realistic about the way the world is. It's also open to, though it's a little weird about how it handles history. It's comfortable with kind of things next to each other, old and new, which is the way the liturgy always works. There's something ancient next to something contemporary in the sense that there's always, you know, the church is always producing and praising in its own idiom, and postmodernism is perfectly fine with that. You know, an ancient Kyrie next to a modern hymn. It's cool. You know, that works. They're open to that. The other thing is that the questioning of absolute authority is not a bad thing. Probably the Reformation did that. You know, the Reformation said, no, you know, the papacy cannot dictate what you believe. Sola scriptura. Ultimately, finally, it's a believer in the Word of God. Within the community of believers, and that's also a postmodern concept, is that we do not like read a text alone, but we read it in a community, and we're kind of norming each other, and that so that they would go against that isolated individualism by saying, the text creates a community. You know, so I think there's potentially some really good thing. It is a reaction against the optimism of modernism that through the right policies, through technology, and that we can create a kind of a utopia. We can heal all disease. We can fix all social ills, and we can't.
But it still retains the fundamental assumption of modernism, which is pragmatism. Whatever works is right.
That's right.
And that's like the huge thing that we as Christians have to deal with, because that's the underlying fallacy, which is exactly what we have to continually preach against. It's not whatever works is right.
Now there's a strong question, and I'm open to this discussion, is that whether we actually are really in a postmodern age, or as Thomas Oden says, we're in the death of modernity. That postmodernism is hard to get a grab on, and I'm not really sure that you can point to things that are necessarily characteristically postmodern in our culture yet, but we're getting there. I think actually the Da Vinci Code is a really good example of something that blurs fiction and reality to such an extent that you really can no longer tell. It's kind of like the Truman Show. Remember that movie, The Truman Show, whose life was a TV show? It was real for him, but not for anybody else.
Yeah.
That's a great exercise. I love that kind of mind game. But that's kind of what the Da Vinci Code does. It's fiction, but it's not what it is. But it all depends, you know, who's asking.
Matrix.
Yes. Yeah. They're playing with that. So that's at least, you know, that's some idea. Rhetoric's not new. You know, Aristotle had three categories of rhetoric. There's ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos was the credential of the speaker. Speaker had to win the confidence and the trust of the hearers. You know, you don't. That's not an auto. That's, and especially these days, that's not a given. Just because you wear stoles, just because you hold office, doesn't mean that they have to listen to you. And so I think every speech act, like a sermon, there is a sense of winning the trust of the hearer, because it's a trust relationship. It's just like when my wife went into surgery, you know, one of the questions we ask each other, you trust that surgeon that we just talked to, because it's a trust relationship. And I think pastor and people's a trust relationship. We're Seelsorge, you know, we're doctors of soul. And so the same with a sermon. I think a lot of sermonic energy has to be put into winning that trust. I heard good examples, both the sermons today, where you know, two guys in totally different ways, admittedly, both admitted being nervous in front of their fellow preachers, who are really good guys and probably good friends, but nonetheless, you know, we're at that level of craftsmen, we're a little self-conscious about it, but in their own ways sought to win the trust of everybody. I do the same, you know. I do the same thing when I'm talking to you. I feel like I'm not qualified to be here, but I'm going to work to win your trust so we can have a conversation. I think we do that with every sermon. We do hearer identification. We do hearer description. where we describe in general terms their lives, and they say, he knows how it's like. You know, he understands me, or he understands how I feel or how I think. And that's really important. I don't think that's a waste of time in sermons to make that bond of identification. When we fail, then very often there's just a misfiring in the hearing. We get tuned out. Kids tune us out a lot because we're speaking from the parental level, and they're really used to tuning out their parents. They do it, you know, 7 days a week, and so their fathers in the faith too. That's kind of a challenge, and I always find challenging to talk to teenagers because I don't have kids, and so I cut a deal with them. I said, okay, I can speak to you as a child or as an emerging adult. What you want? I don't believe in adolescence. It's just a hormonal state of being. So I said, adult. I said, cool. Okay, I'll talk to you like an adult. That's nice. But I'm playful and teasing with them because I want to win their confidence, and I want them to trust me. Pathos is one we're not good at as Lutherans, and especially as confessional Lutherans or conservative. That's the emotional side. That's the appeal to the heart. And that ain't unbiblical, or that's not unbiblical. Read, Paul bleeds, you know. I'm speaking to as a father, he says, to his children. What are you doing? You know, to Corinthians, he's heartbroken over this. Galatians, you stupid Galatians, you know, he was betraying me. And in fact, if you look at how he proves that the circumcision party is wrong in Galatians, he uses all the elements of rhetoric. He makes an emotional appeal. He makes a factual appeal to Scripture. He makes a logical appeal. So any way you slice it, you're not going to get away from this, you know. I read somewhere that thinkers and feelers are 50-50, apparently, but 65% of men are thinkers. So the appeal is logos, logic. 65% of women are feelers. The appeal is emotion. And Craig Parton, my good buddy, have you read Craig Parton on The Defense Never Rests? Great little book on apologetics. But he talks about apologetics for the tough-minded, that's logos, and the tender-hearted, see, and that's pathos. I think the liturgy speaks to the tender-hearted. I think music speaks to the tender-hearted. I think art, you know, it's those intuitive people, those people who just kind of, they see this huge, big picture. Unfortunately, a lot of us are very logical. Mathematician, chemist, good grief. It doesn't get more off the scale logical than that. And so I have to be careful to say, I think I know how you feel about this. I think, help me. But that's good. Even admitting you're not sure is a way to win trust. Because they say, he's trying. He's trying to be sympathetic. You know, and that's good. I think that's, quite frankly, just speaking brother to brother, I think that's where I see a lot of my younger confessional brothers failing here, is they're failing to make the emotional appeal. It's a passion. We love the confessions because this is the gospel, and we want everybody to have the full joy, and it is a full joy. It's not just a matter about being right and wrong. It's a matter about the fullest joy of our salvation. And I think sometimes we don't make the relational connection so much. We're more interested in putting down the, you know, just putting down the barrier, right and wrong, your side. Are you on this side or are you on that side? That's why Barnabas impressed me so much. Nobody wants to talk to Saul because he's dangerous. So Barnabas goes and gets Saul, you know. So it's really both and not an either or.
So do you get emotional in your preaching sometimes?
You know, sometimes I do. Because I'm not good with my emotions, I don't have any control over them. It's really bad. But it's okay. People are used to that.
That happens to me sometimes.
Good. And I'm unapologetic about it. It's like, all right, you know. It's like, good grief, he took his own word seriously. The word had an effect on him. And, you know, I mean, and it just kind of, it just comes and goes. But, I mean, you can't orchestrate that. And I think it's more kind of, it's that connection is, and a lot of it is in vivid descriptions, describing your life in such a way that people recognize. And I use my life. I don't use people as an example. I don't even make up people as an example because they think I'm violating the confessional. You know, remember, you're hearing confession. Don't use people as examples in your sermons. It's bad. They wouldn't trust you. That's an old-fashioned way of communicating. I love that. And there was communion. He had to actually reach over and
the you know, in your appeal for emotional, the text is rich with it. So often it is. But I think when you look at the demographics of our church, we're growing more and more women than men attending services on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this plea, how do you reach out to them?
Mm-hmm.
And it's so easy to kind of, who is talking about the emails they got that, Kent in the sermon, about the emails you get that are just drippy, right? And, you know, I could use that. That would make them cry. You know, but that's not the emotion that we're...
No. Yeah, and that's manipulation. That's, see, right. And that's we're so afraid of manipulating. That we just stay away from that whole feeling aspect of, and it's not really that at all. It's read the Psalms. I mean, you know, out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. That's not a logical statement. I mean, he's in the pits, and he's crying, and he feels it in his bones, and stuff. And I think that it's that vividness of language that just works with the full palette.
Yeah. Just going back to the postmodern audiovisual tendencies that we have. A lot of pastors in my area are starting to use multimedia, if you want to call it that, in their sermons to try and achieve this emotion type thing. So anything from, I've seen a clip of Patch Adams played and then
mm-hmm.
a discourse on that to simply a sermon based on three different pieces of Christian art,
mm-hmm.
and drawing out like your icon example. So relating the text to this icon and helping them out with the symbolism a little bit and allowing them to go on their Easter egg hunt.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of a mixed bag of an example there, but oh, I see. My line is Easter. They're helping them along finding the little fun
right,
things
but
in the
icon. But they're allowing them to.
Yeah.
Use these
okay.
other, rather than just the oral language, they're allowing these other elements to assist them or enhance the sermon message, connecting
okay.
with them emotionally.
Yeah, I think I know where you're going. I'm going to say something that I'm going to, this is a first. You guys are going to witness a first for me. Is I'm going to put a disclaimer on this. That is, this is my opinion, and this is my practice. I believe in it, but your mileage may vary. But I'm going to say this that. I think that my feeling is that the craft of preaching really deserves to stand on its own and not with the crutches of visuals. I'm really good with PowerPoint, but I don't use it in the sermon. I use it when I talk to the kids, you know, higher things. All the kids go, dude, you got PowerPoint? Yeah, I got PowerPoint. Yeah, that's how they choose when they come. But here's what I've discovered, because I'm good with that, and I think I'm good with that. I mean, I can handle the images. I have a good eye for balance, and I know how not to cram screens with stuff and all of that. But here's what I find is what I lose is I lose immediacy. I'm committed. If I cook up a multimedia thing, I'm committed. I can't change course. I can change course in a sermon at any moment, even with a manuscript. If I'm catching blank stares, I can move in other directions. And Augustine talks about that in preaching. He says the old guys didn't like manuscripts. It's don't trust a guy who reads anything. You know, he's got to note his stuff. But what they wanted was constant interaction, visual dialogue. And so he said, so you can tell immediately, do I have to say it again? Do I have to turn it a different way? And I guess I'm just challenging myself. I'm just going to speak this way. I'm challenging myself to address this visual audio culture by using word pictures as richly as possible and by making as engaging contact as I personally am able and to somehow sort of crack through that. Because I really do believe there's a place for the spoken word and a place to train ears to hear, you know. That's my commitment in preaching. I'm not asking anybody to buy into that. That's kind of an opinion, but I do believe that this is a high art that we're given to do, and the other stuff that goes. When I do PowerPoints, I'm committed to an outline. They don't call it PowerPoint for nothing. I can power through every point. And not give a damn about you. And I've done it. When I teach at Irvine, I get so ticked at my classes sometimes because I teach this course, an intro to Old Testament, intro to New Testament, required course, athletes, they don't want to be there. You know, and sometimes I just get so mad at them, I'm just clicking on my clicker and just, here, you know, this is what you got to memorize, okay? Write these down. This ain't teaching. There's no communion in this. This is just irritation. But I can use the tool. I can use the tool like that because I can power through my points very quickly. But I have no flexibility there. And I'm committed to the set of slides and these pictures and everything else. Whereas there's something really, really terrifying about standing in front of a group of people and taking a detour. Because it has occurred, it seemed good to me and the Holy Spirit that we go down this road. And all of a sudden it is Father, you know. My dad never had PowerPoint at the kitchen table. For that matter, he didn't have a manuscript. He just presided.
That's dangerous logic, though, because I could say the same thing for the liturgy. I don't want to be bound to a liturgy that's PowerPointed on a hymnal page. Mm-hmm. I want the freedom to go where the Spirit leads me.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I like when I'm trapped by my own logic. I would say this in response. In order to have the freedom to do that in a sermon, I need fences put around me so I don't kick the ball out in the street and that. And that's what the liturgy is for me. It is a fence around the playground, inside of which the free children are free to play. But we need fences, because otherwise you don't know where the boundary lines are. The liturgy guards my ears against bad sermons. It ensures that Christ is proclaimed, even if I'm having a really bad hair day. And see, the sermon, of all the things in the liturgy, the sermon is the least certain and the most tenuous because it's immediate. Reading scriptures, can't go wrong there. Read them. And really, the Lord's Supper, you know, if you can speak and you can hold up bread and wine, it's really mechanically all it takes. Can't go wrong there. The sermon, there are a bazillion ways this can go wrong. And so for that reason, I like the fence and the protect. I need that protection around that. I got to protect that place because it is the least reliable. It's the most tenuous of the things in the liturgy. And as a result, it's most kairotic. It's a moment between the preacher and his people. It's deeply personal, too. So that would be my response. I agree with you, but I see them serving different functions, different purposes.
On the question of you using visuals, do you refer to the church architecture? Do you sweep your hand to the Lord's table?
Yeah.
Do you point to the banners and use the banners potentially?
That's at times when it's there. I mean, it's not a regular feature, but yeah. I mean, obviously.
Which to me is a different thing altogether than even bringing in an icon and doing that, which is a foreign thing brought in. But certainly different than a PowerPoint presentation or something like that. But I have a hard time articulating that to a parishioner who wants to see those things, thinks they're great. How I can say no to one and not, and to me, I don't have any problem personally. I my gut says, yeah, of course you point to the pyramids and use the pyramids to help you preach if it fits. But I don't want the other, and I just... me, it's the explanation is a challenge.
Yeah, I know, and again, that's why I had the disclaimer in front of it, because some of it is not logically defensible. Other than to say this, the people who go to my Bible classes, where I will use anything available, and hear my preaching, I think by and large would not have it any other way. In fact, I joked, you know, I was running through a Higher Things presentation, so I brought, you know, we have a projector, and I brought my laptop, you know, PowerBook G4, nice machine, but brought it in, and I said, this is just warm up for church, you know, and there's this collective groan, don't you dare. It's okay. But I think they see both, and I think they understand both. Well, they are different forms of speaking, and they know that they're not going to get the same kind of thing if I'm commenting on a visual as if I'm trying to paint a visual with my own words or with words. So some of it is kind of, it can't be logically demonstrated, it's just kind of check it out, see what the difference is. You know, how do I logically tell you the difference between a Macintosh apple and a Golden Delicious? Now you got to taste it. You know, you'll see the difference.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I've gone through some of that process. We've used the projection for the liturgy and the sermon for about 6 years, and I can see how my sermons have changed over that 6 years. When I started, or, you know, if this is neat, let's do bullets. Let's, you know, give them outlines and all this. And I would do a sermon, and I might have 25 slides looking through, because I usually preach about a half an hour. So, but now I probably most weeks just use 5 or 6 slides for a half hour sermon, and then I've sort of come along into seeing that, yeah, I don't want to be caught so much, and I don't want them all looking up there. And
yeah, that's true.
I've just changed.
So look at me for it. Yeah, stop looking at that screen. That's cool.
Moved into some of that, and a lot less.
Yeah, and that's cool. I think sometimes you just have to sort of prove that for yourself, or check it out. I appreciate that. You know, to say, you know, it gets a cool toy. This is gonna work. This is gonna get to them. And then you realize, no, they stare at screens every day of their lives. And so they know how to tune that baby out too. And so, good, I appreciate that. Preaching, some characteristics about preaching that I wrote down. I think preaching today really has to be textual. As much as I love my pastors who confirmed me, his preaching, yeah, he announced a text, but the text was a pretext for another text that he had in mind, and it was usually a doctrine. But I think today preaching really has to be textual. People need to be stuck back in the scriptures. And it's almost I wouldn't say expository, but text exposition is another key element of preaching. Beyond hearer, you know, winning the trust of the hearers, hearer identification, hearer description, text exposition. Luther did it all the time. And you read Luther's sermons, about two-thirds of Luther's, by weight of Luther's sermons, are simply expositions of the text. Unpacking the text, retelling the story. I love retelling biblical narrative. And I take example from Luther. I fill in the gaps. I modernize them. You know, I did a little bit of that, Paul and Barnabas, sitting looking at road maps, pictures from their last trip, saying, that was great, let's do it again, you know. But it's just painting it vividly. Running this narrative is very vivid. Those are wonderful narratives in the Gospels and the Old Testament. Man, they're loaded with stuff. If we have time, I might do a little exercise on reading through the gaps of David and Bathsheba. That thing is a loaded narrative. That thing, oh, you can have huge fun. We know the story. We learned it, probably not in Sunday school. That's not a Sunday school. We know that story. But that story is loaded. It's full of holes. And it's just inviting all kinds of questions. And in the end, you have more questions than you got answers about what's going on there. And I love that. I think you can unpack that. One of the things that I hear from some of my old-time members, they say, I know that Bible narrative better than I ever knew before. I take that as a real compliment, that they have come to a deeper appreciation for the characters, the interaction, the sights, the sounds, the smells. And it's all in the text, I think, or it's at least in the holes of the text. You can play there. And your research, knowing what you know about biblical history, is important. It's got to be textual. It also has to be contextual, meaning that we're preaching in today. And that's an awareness of what's going on in the world. I don't think the newspaper dictates what you preach on, but I do think that major things in the news have to somehow get acknowledged in whatever tech. That has to be acknowledged. We're in the world, not of it, but we're in it. It has to be relational. Especially the younger crowd is hungry for relations. They have no clue as to how to form a relationship. And I think it has to. What we have to do is we have to speak to them in such a way that we are forming a bond And I'm scared of that. I really don't want a personal relationship with all these people, but they do. And I think the pastoral office really sort of demands that. I know we were supposed to hide behind an official thing, but there's a person in that office. There's a flesh and blood person. I'm sorry, you're in the glare,
If we are a body, various members of the body, how would you like your body not to have any relationship, one member to the other?
Exactly.
That's God's doing. It's not our plan.
It's not what?
It's not our plan. It's something C.S. Lewis was getting hyped up about, that we expect all Christians to look alike, like our eyeball looks like our toe, and like it's the way God does it. And you can't be separate unless you're dead.
And if you're separate, you will die.
In terms of our preaching, in terms of our trust of our congregation, they're God's gifts to us. We cut the relationship as much as we like to be mathematicians in our closet. We're dead, and we wonder why. We got to suffer with them, not fix them.
I think that's an amen from across the room.
Yes.
Yes. I like that. I think preaching today needs to be apologetic in many respects too, and that's part of equipping the saints to be out in the world to answer, to give a defense for the hope that is in them. Every Easter, the entire Easter season is filled with apologetic stuff. I mean, none of the evangelists leave you in the lurch as to why they believe that Jesus is risen from the dead. And they have answered all the contemporary objections, from the disciples stole the body to whatever. They've answered all of these things. And I think we need to just hold them out, 500 eyewitnesses. I've even included, I kind of add that into the proper preface for Easter. Who with Mary Magdalene, together with Mary Magdalene and James, and Mary Magdalene and Peter and the disciples and 500 eyewitnesses with angels and with archangels, and, just kind of keep drumming it in. This is a fact of history witnessed. Because there's so much that says, no, it's not. It's just somebody made that up for fun and profit. I think preaching needs to be dialogical again. Not that bad dialogue sermon stuff they were doing in the 70s when I was growing up. Man, that was bad. But both you guys did it today is questions. I love the use of questions, rhetorical questions. What do you think? what would you do? I don't expect an answer. I do have some people who answer once in a while. That's okay. We're there. The kids answer. Yes, they do. And that's a good thing. They actually feel free enough to talk back to that guy. And I remember one time I described something about, but it was a healing miracle in doctors, and I described something about the waiting room. And one of the, this man, his wife was sick with cancer for 2.5 years. He just lived under the doctors. And he's a very conservative man. And he would never do anything to draw attention to himself. And he just blurted out, "That's exactly the way it was." And I said, "You know what I'm talking about." He said, "That's right." But I mean, that was just a great moment. If you know this guy would never speak out loud in church like that. And he just heard something that just described 2.5 years of misery with his wife under that. He says, "That's exactly the way it was." I love that. But that's honest. That's an honest dialogue. Have you ever preached like an all black church? Yeah. Oh, was that great?
Yeah, the Sudanese, clap.
They clap.
When they're happy. And the women, when they are happy about a sermon, they will get up and they will start to sing a song. Sometimes they'll ask, but it's that high-pitched thing they do with their tongue that you see in the movies with, like, Lawrence of Arabia, that la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Get 200 of them in your church. And, 60% of the population is female or more, and they're all doing that because they liked the sermon. And then they start to sing their song.
It's like, this thing's out of control.
No organ, it's all drum.
Yeah.
And you just say, what in the world just happened?
Yeah, now, you know, don't try that at home. You get a bunch of white people doing that. That's like a white reggae band, you know? They're playing the right notes, but the beat's just...
My dream is when it comes out, I hope our congregation gets it, and then I want to voice the Spanish hymn, Alaba Rey, on my German-speaking white... blue-haired ladies and make them sing the whole Spanish version with me.
By us, that'd be just, you know, that'd be par for the course, you know. the some of those African hymns are gorgeous too. Yeah. They really have, it's just wonderful. I preached in northern Muskogee on Vicarage, and I also did a funeral for one of our members who's a very large Black Baptist family and stuff. Man, there's energy there, you know, even for this you know, white kid from Chicago, you know, because you're going along and you're hearing people going, and this is not show either, and then you hit one as a amen, and pretty soon you're there's energy coming back at you. It's a remarkable dialogue that cannot be reproduced. You can't make that happen. That is just, it's in there. But to experience that, and I think even in our ways, within the strictures of our cultures, that kind of recognition that you and I are on a wavelength here. God is speaking, and I'm hearing what you're saying. And I think that's where a lot of the technology can get in the way, potentially, can get in the way. Even the microphone can get in the way. Because we've lost the sort of the full palette of our voice. Thank God we've lost pulpit tone, but you know, and God said, but we've also lost that ability to whisper loud. There's the focused intensity to that. Preaching has to be vivid. Primary colors. This is a culture with a short attention span, which is nice because you don't have to make long reasoned arguments because they can't follow them anyway. So instead you spin around in circles like that, and you do John and the Revelation, and then I saw, and then I saw, and then, and they're fine with that as long as you're just trying to make one point, or just a tight string of points. But it has to be vivid. And I think one thing I mean by vivid, the device that I use a lot is historical present. Not Jesus went to Jerusalem, Jesus goes to Jerusalem. Historians do that all the time when they're trying to be interesting. And it works, because it's like, oh, I'm there. You know, I'm there. You know, this guy actually, you know, we're right there. The present is, and Mark does that once in a while too. He's very vivid in that way. Our preach has to be authoritative without being institutional. There's a challenge. How to be authoritative without being institutional. What does that mean? I think one thing it means is being unapologetic about what you say. Prophetic preaching is thus says the Lord. But it's thus says the Lord, not thus says the church. Thus says the Lord. And I think that's about all I want to say on that.
When I had the word winsome.
Winsome?
Yeah.
Winsome.
It comes up a lot.
Winsome is relational.
Is it?
Winsome is relational. Winsome cares about what effect my words have on people. Because, you know, I don't mind if they feel bad, so long as they feel bad about their sinfulness. They should feel bad. And if they don't feel bad, they ought to feel bad about that. You know, but if I...
Is that a way to bring authority, though, from a church to the people? Is winsome a good... like you were saying, how do you do that? How do you bring an authoritative institution to the people? Do you winsome?
Most of you are husbands, many of you are fathers. You know, we are heads of our household, but we know that we don't dare say that a lot. You do that. You don't say it, you just do it.
I did that.
Once. Yes. And you never did that again. No, that's right. Because as head of the household, she is held up high. That's your job. She's queen. See, and when she's queen, she's happy about that. But you never say, I'm king, therefore you're queen. So how am I queen?
The whole house is happy.
The pastor is like that too. Pastoral authority is huge authority.
That's right.
It's huge authority. So don't keep using, don't keep beating people over the head with it, because it's for the forgiveness of sins. And let the kids play once in a while. Just let them do dumb things. And say, oh, I get it. You know, it's like sometimes, I think the reason I've been in my congregation for as long as I have, I'll tell you the secret, because I'm out of my, except for you, and you're sworn to secrecy. Okay, so is that the reason is I don't want the next pastor to see how big of a mess it really is. I'm embarrassed for my children. What?
He will anyway.
He will. I know that. I know that. In God's good time, he will. But I'm hoping to fix a few things before it happens. but pastoral authority, I think, has to be used with what Dan Fogelberg said this of his father, a thundering velvet hand. It's strong, but it's gentle. It's, or Richard Robert Havda, strong, loving, wise. Yeah. That's the presider at the liturgy. He's strong, he's loving, he's wise, and that's fatherly. It's kind of interesting. They've done a study. Fathers don't even have to do anything with their families. They just have to be present. You know, that's kind of mind-boggling. But there's just something about the presence of father that all of a sudden the family's in order. Hmm. You know, and you've seen that vacant congregations turning into anarchy and running amok when father, but present, you got to be present, which I have to remind myself of that, because I'm prone to isolation. You got to be sitting in the, who said suffering with? You got to be suffering with them. You can't fix their suffering, but you can be like Ezekiel and sit for 7 days appalled. I love that. I sat for 7 days at the River Kabar appalled. I've sat for 14 years appalled. But you're with them. Anyway, that's all of this then goes into kind of a poetics of preaching, which I'm gonna spill into the discussion thing with this writing for the ear, because I think that there still is hope. I'm holding out this hope for the word. To be able to paint pictures that are vivid enough for an audiovisual culture to apprehend. And what I'm hoping they do is they say, oh, this is really different from anything else we get. That's why I like chant, because it's not music, it's not singing, it's speech, but it's not speech the way we normally hear it. In fact, I would put out a plea that maybe we should think about composing the liturgy in a kind of a chant idiom. So we wouldn't get tired of it, and we would stay with it for a few hundred years, and we would memorize it, so we don't have to have it either projected or in the book, and we agree it's and with your spirit, and so that we can extend both hands in acknowledgement back to the presider, and then begin to dance instead of looking at the footprints and counting 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 all the time. See, but because we constantly have this itch for variety, musical variety, textual variety, we're not dialoguing in the liturgy. That's the thing that I'm talking about in preaching is not happening in the liturgy. I finally, after 12 years, have sprung free of the agenda book. I can turn to the people and chant, "The Lord be with you," and they say, "And also with you," or "And with your spirit," at the same time. So I go, and then you know, "Lift up your hearts." Which, by the way, that's a poor translation. You know that? Lift up your hearts. Sursum corda, hearts up. Yeah. Of course, the response would be, "Up yours." No, that's cheap humor. That's terrible. Hearts up. They are up with the Lord. They are toward the Lord. They are toward the Lord. Like Jesus, he lifted his eyes to heaven. Not. It's not too much lifting. That's gymnastics. Lift. You know, feel the burn. But we do that. But we can say that dialogue back and forth without looking down at something. We're looking each other in the face and in the eye. And then what happens is Bible study. The Lord be with you and with your spirit. Let us pray. The kids on youth retreat. The Lord be with you and with your spirit. You know, let us give thanks. Let us bless the Lord. Thanks be to God. We know the dialogue. We know the lines. Now we're actually in communion. See, I wish for that. Because I think the worship wars would quiet down a lot if some real ballroom dancing were going on.
not liturgical dance, I'm talking about, you know, it's verbal dance back and forth. What I want to look at when we come back, because I exceeded my amt here, is some of the, I think, important rhetorical picture tools that I find very, very valuable in minding my words, and maybe we can kick them around a little bit and see what you think, and look at your own kind of style of preaching, and you do it. Yeah, I heard great, I've heard great examples from, you know, the two guys who've been preaching, lots of great little rhetorical things to catch the ear. And you do it quite naturally. I guess what I want to do is kind of make them a little bit, you know, hold them up a little bit, and you know, look to see what else could be done there, so that our preaching remains vivid, and hearable. One thing about an oral culture is they love to play with words. Read the Psalms in Hebrew, alliterations, acrostics, all kinds of things to grab the ear, because they could hear it once and then say it back again. And even in the New Testament, there's a rhythm to these things so that you could hear it and then say it again. And I think that's what we've lost that. And I think there's great hope in this postmodern era of recovering a new orality. People don't read books anymore, they do books on tape, they listen to them. I did a huge run of Bible cassettes, Bible on tape. They love it. And I thought, that's great. That's the way, that's what Paul said should be done. Listen to it.
Podcasting.
So it's not bad. Their ears are plugged in quite nicely. And the iPod doesn't have any visuals. Well, it does now. It's got a screen.
Isn't that what catechesis is all about?
Huh?
Catechesis, that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Catechesis? Well,
they hear it and they say it back.
They literally echo it back,
right.
And it's actually, the goal is not that they memorize it, the goal is the conversation. Footnote to that, we always do catechesis, a little chunk in our divine service every Sunday, right after I call it my children's sermon, but we're all children then, and we just take a portion of the catechism, reprint it in the bulletin, and we speak it back to each other and do about two sentences. A little bit of discussion. So far, the catechism. And I think that keeps the catechism alive also in the hearing of the adults, too. So, okay. When we come back, maybe that we'll look at.